Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Now, stag woody game. Who's going first? Shall I go first?
Because I've got. If you want to go first, go on. Go on.
Okay. Think crystals. Think soulful pictures of Scandinavian landscapes through mists. Think Northern Europe. Think New Age.
New Age music.
Think New Age groups. Okay, New Age tends to be a genre dominated by solo artists, but there are groups. Okay, here are five. One of them was made up. Okay,
here are five.
Alpha Wave Movement.
These are good. Yeah, go on. Good.
Deep Forest. Emerald Web.
I like the little whispered refrain. It's kind of mindfulness, isn't it? It's
ethereal. Jade Egg. Wave Star. Those five again. Alpha Wave Movement, Deep Forest, Emerald Web, Jade Egg, and Wave Star. Which one is the phony? Over to you, Mark Allen.
That is absolutely brilliant. Alpha Wave Movement. That sounds real. Deep Forest, I'm sure, is real. I'm sure, is Wave Star. Do you know, I'm thinking Jade Egg for the simple reason that Jade Egg has associations with the kind of Gwyneth Paltrow end.
That's exactly what it is. You bastard.
That's precisely
what it is. I pinched it from Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, right. I've rumbled you. That's absolutely brilliant.
Jade Egg is a kind of, I don't know, it's a love toy or whatever.
It's a love toy sold for kind of, you know, $755 or whatever. Oh, God. Well, at least we're not getting into a conversation about the scented candles. That's fantastic, Dave. That's a really good category. This is a good category. Well, look, I've got for you acts who've used pseudonyms for secret gigs.
All right. Oh, that's a good one.
Acts have used it to five examples. Four are real. One is a cunning invention. Okay. So, did Iron Maiden once play a gig billed as the entire population of Hackney? Did the Libertines ever appear several times, in fact, as Gums and Roses?
Gums and Noses.
It's right. Gums and Noses. Sorry. The Rolling Stones once played secret shows, is this true, in Toronto and Paris as the Cockroaches. Jarvis Cocker once appeared as Darren Spooner in the band Relaxed Muscle, the sound of young Doncaster. All right. And did Genesis appear as Squonk at the Marquee in 1976 and a week later as the Colony of Slippermen? God. So there you are. Iron Maiden, the entire population of Hackney. The Libertines, Gums and Noses. Rolling Stones as the Cockroaches. Jarvis Cocker as Darren Spooner in the band Relaxed Muscle. As I say, the sound of young Doncaster. And Genesis, a Squonk, and then a week later as the Colony of Slippermen.
Well, it's a very good thread. I haven't a clue. I'm going to guess the Cockroaches.
Oh, what? It's made up? No, that's real.
Oh, well, okay, fine.
Oh, so that's real. No, that's real. I thought I'd rather give it away with the Gums and Noses.
You're the winner this week. So who's the made-up one?
No, the made-up one is Genesis, who never appeared as Squonk. In fact, they did have a track called Squonk.
They did have a track.
And they had a track called The Colony of Slipmen. I can't remember. I think they were on The Lamb Lies Down at Broadway and possibly Trick of the Tail. But they never actually appeared. They did appear as The Garden Wall, in fact, which is not a very exciting name. But there we are. So you're this week's winner. I've triumphed.
So yesterday afternoon, we're recording this on Sunday. Yesterday afternoon, I was sitting there. I was multi-screening. I was doing some work. I was keeping track of the football on one screen. And I was keeping track of CNN, which is my channel of choice when it comes to coverage of the American election. Have you been watching?
Who were the first? No, I haven't. And everyone, there's so many people.
CNN have just been brilliant. And particularly this guy, John King, who's their kind of stats guy, is the man in charge of electronic map. And he has set new standards for kind of command of the facts and figures and coolness under pressure. He was set standards that will resound around the world of broadcasting. And all these people will have to up their game in the light of what this guy did. I've never seen such cool. I've never seen such ability to be able to make calculations in his head while operating this unbelievably sophisticated touchscreen, which did everything they wanted it to do. Anyway, the weird thing about CNN is that they're not just reporting the news, they're kind of making the news, because when it comes to election, they have to decide when they're going to call it. You know what I mean?
And they were the first to call it, weren't they?
Well, were they? I do not know. I just happened to be watching it. They probably were, you know, because they possibly have more resources. They probably have more boots on the ground than anybody else when it comes to a story like this. And so they'd been, frankly, they'd been kind of treading water for about 24 hours because they'd had to. You know, they'd been running over the same things. We're waiting for the count in this county and so forth, and that will tell us a little bit more about the trend and where it's going and so forth. And then suddenly they switched without warning, while I only had half an eye on the screen, to announcing. So you get Sting, you get the boom, you know, Wolf Blitzer appears there and goes, CNN is now prepared to project that the next president of the United States is Joe Biden. And a sudden graphic of Joe Biden and all this starts happening. And so the channel suddenly immediately switches from speculation about what might happen next to acceptance that this is what has happened. And now it's loads of reflection about what does this mean for the country and all that kind of stuff. And so I immediately switched. I immediately went to the New York Times site, and they also had announced, you know. So I flicked round NBC, they'd announced. I don't know whether they'd done it like 30 seconds after CNN or what. I don't know. But, you know, the result was.
Had
the
he
same.
Won Pennsylvania at that point?
No, because he's.
I don't think he had.
No, he still hasn't. But they've been, you know, for the previous 24, 48 hours, they've been looking at the trend, and they kept going back to their decision desk, who are the boffins upstairs who decide when it is safe for them to risk their reputation by saying, this is what's going to happen. And he had been explaining, chap from Decision Desk had been explaining regularly, well, we're watching for the trend. As long as it stays over 65%, it cannot go back or something like this. And so they obviously reached the point where...
I know, that's all agreed. I mean, lots of people have reached that point.
If you're going to wait... If you're going to wait until absolutely every last vote, you're going to be late. Because the funny thing is, 2 minutes after I looked at the New York Times site, I look at the BBC site and say, the BBC is prepared to announce. And I thought, oh, come on, that's rich. The BBC is watching the same television as everybody else.
They're thinking, well, if CNN have gone with it, it's safe for us to do so. Yeah, so exactly.
That's at that point I tweeted that Smash Hits is now prepared to predict.
I saw that.
Yeah. It's I don't see the point of watching British broadcasters during an event like this in contemporary in the communications universe that we live in nowadays, where, you know, the people nearest to the story are the Americans.
Precisely.
And you can watch them just as easily as you can watch anything else. So why wouldn't you? I simply don't understand. So It was
so fascinating because somebody had to go with it first, and the only thing that could possibly overturn it is any of these spurious legal actions that Trump is taking, none of which are going to amount to anything. The thing that excited me most, I watched so much this last night, was the idea that somebody said that Trump was now a flight risk. Are you following this? The idea that he could just get on an airplane in the dead of night and fly somewhere abroad. I've got this romantic fantasy that then tries to live in complete anonymity. And I can't think of anybody less well-equipped to live in anonymity in some kind of bunker somewhere to avoid the ruinous lawsuits, because he has countless lawsuits, doesn't he? About the billions of dollars he owes, about his tax evasion. I mean, absolutely astonishing. All of which he couldn't be held to account over while he was the president of the United States. So he's got that hanging over him.
I feel sorry for
the way he's going to live. He can't really return to New York, can he? I can't imagine him returning.
I don't think
to live in Florida. Yeah.
I feel very sorry for anybody who's involved in the. They're going to have to have a recount in Georgia, aren't they? Because it's within
the 0.05 parameters.
And so some poor sods are going to have to, you know, work for like 2 or 3 days or whatever, going through all this, even though nobody in the world, apart from one person,
only one person believes, would possibly care,
believes,
that and it won't make any difference anyway.
Anything at all,
and it won't affect things anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So, riveting day. And what an amazing thing, dear. A little tiny ray of sunshine. I got all these texts from various people. One of my sisters and my brother-in-law, you know, with a bottle of champagne. You know, it's so nice because people just can't quite process good news. We're not used to it.
Yeah. Well, it's a long way to go, I'm sure. I mean, some might say that the best thing he could probably do is run away to Saudi Arabia or, you know, anything rather than the damage that he could do in the next 11 weeks.
Well, as he only did one term, of course, he can run for another term. So in 4 years' time, he could be campaigning to come back. So there is that hanging over us too.
Yeah, well, so... but for the moment, you know, it's just nice to have one less prick to worry about.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So we just heard that if live music and live theatre returns in next year, there's lots of exciting new things we look forward to, Mark, aren't there?
Including an Osmonds musical. That's the pinnacle, isn't it? That's what we've been dreaming of. That's it's going to kickstart the entertainment industry. Crazy Horses, I should imagine it'll be cool.
It'll also be presumably the Osmonds done by people who are not the Osmonds. So it does work, really, does it? Yeah, I mean, Donnie's still with us, isn't he? I mean, why can't he? Or is he?
Well, musicals traditionally are done by people who aren't the original cast.
I suppose. That is true. Oh, I also read Alex is sending us messages as they come in that Steps are returning too. I suppose, you know, in this unique situation, you may as well just say, no matter how hopeless you are, you may as well just say, we're planning a major world tour next year, because you probably won't be called.
Because you almost certainly won't do it, but you'll certainly get the publicity, which is what you need to keep the old back catalogue floating. I know.
So in other pop news, very sad to note the death of Jeffrey Palmer.
Jeffrey Palmer. Yeah, I suppose that is pop news. What a great man. And also, I suppose he would define the word lugubrious, wouldn't he? There was an obit written about him in The Guardian, described his bloodhound face, jowly and still, and his hooded eyes, and how he used to play figures of authority and moral rectitude. And actually, I don't think he was really like that in real life, was he? So imagine going through your entire life acting. No, you've adopted a role that is nothing like what you're actually like. It must be very confusing for people.
So Danny Kelly and I were discussing him on Twitter, and of course he's associated in my mind with primarily actually with his marvelous appearance in Fawlty Towers.
That's my favourite Fawlty Towers moment. I'm going to remind you, my favourite Fawlty Towers moment of all of them is when they discover that the hotel guest is dead in his bed with his breakfast tray. And unless I'm entirely mistaken, Basil thinks it's because the kippers are beyond their sell-by date and the kippers have killed him. So he starts to try and throw the kippers kipper out the window, at which point Sybil feels his pulse and then looks at him again. She says, he hasn't touched the kippers. And then Basil says something like, he's stone dead. He's stone cold. He said, oh, joy, thank you, God. I'm so happy. And he's just jumping up and down because the man is dead, because he hasn't touched his kippers. At which point, Jeffrey Palmer walks into the room, doesn't he, I think?
Jeffrey Palmer is a doctor and he's staying in the hotel. And he's called upon to pronounce the man dead, which he does.
And
then Jeffrey, with that kind of utter kind of realism that characterizes the doctors as a profession, because they deal with life and death and they have to get on with it. at every moment.
Yeah.
He then returns to what he really wants out of life, which is he wants sausages, doesn't he?
That's his main thing is sausages.
He wants sausages.
That's all he cares about. He's absolutely insistent.
He goes into he ends up in the kitchen doing them himself. And there's a wonderful line.
Carting the corpse past in a wicker basket.
I thought you were a doctor. He says, I'm a doctor and I want my sausages.
That's right.
God bless him, Jeffrey Palmer. God, that was funny. Now, the thing Danny and I were remembering with great fondness was, of course, his wonderful part in The Fall and Rise of Reginald.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which is... Has there ever been a series that gave birth to so many catchphrases as The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin? You know what I mean? Have a nice day. I won't.
That's right.
And, sorry, I'm late. You know, lions on the line at Clapham Junction or whatever. And then the two, you know, when CJ, I didn't get where I am today without so-and-so.
Yeah.
Whenever he had his two kind of toadies would listen to his ideas, what would they say? Both of them would say a single word. One would go great, and the other one would go super. And it just
I remember that.
You know, I can remember everything about The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin.
Office conversation must have been so changed by that program, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah. And of course, nothing greater than Jeffrey Palmer as his brother-in-law, wasn't he, Jimmy?
Yeah.
Kind of down in his luck military officer. And he'd come round to catch food. And he goes, sorry, I wouldn't bother you. There's been a bit of a cock up on the catering front. Do you remember that?
Yes.
On the catering front.
Yeah.
I remember saying that at work for years. People going, you know, have you got any food in? No, there's been a cock up on the
cock up on the catering front. That's right.
And he also, as Danny reminded me, he uttered the line that still contains the two words that I still think would make the greatest band name ever, which is Rum Cove Johnny Woman. Because I still think Johnny Woman is a brilliant name for a group of either sex. It doesn't matter. It's a great name. But
Is that where it came from?
Rum Cove Johnny Woman.
I'm not sure if I knew that. I thought that was just something we'd invented at Q Magazine.
No. It was Jeffrey Palmer in Reginald Perrin.
A Rum Cove Johnny Woman.
No, just Rum Cove. Rum Cove Johnny Woman.
That's fantastic.
All four words are absolutely perfection.
It's genius. Absolute genius.
So that's David Nobbs writing, of course. But Jeffrey Palmer, we salute the great Jeffrey Palmer. God, he gave us some pleasure over the years. And what was he, 93, I think.
And it's interesting that you know, when serious actors die, you know, people get into the most extraordinary contortions to express how fabulous they were, their art. And there's never that kind of level of understanding and credit for comic actors, I don't think. Do you? It's just not taken seriously. It's like the whole thing about the Oscars. How many great comic actors have won Oscars compared to, the ones who have serious roles? You know, it's incomparable.
Well, it's also, it interests me that Jeffrey Palmer is the kind of person, and Jeffrey Palmer didn't always do comedy. You know, he would have done quite a bit of drama over the years. But he is the kind of person that referred to as a character actor, isn't he?
Yeah, he was. Look,
and I thought, it really intrigues me. What is a character act, really? I kind of understand, but I want to know. And I looked it up, and they said that the main thing that characterises a character actor is they're not the leading man or woman. They're not in the lead, you know. So all our kind of plaudits always go to whoever is in the lead, in the lead part. As if their artistry is consequently greater than anybody else. It's not true at all. It's just the way the drama is done. You know, so Reginald Perrin, Leonard Rossiter, God bless him, he was great. You know,
got all the credit.
So were loads of people in The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin. And going back to Fawlty Towers, I've droned on about this incessantly recently because it struck me again and again.
It's the strength of the cast, isn't it?
It's the strength of them all.
They're phenomenal.
Absolutely everybody who gets on in front of that camera is trying to do the best work they've ever done in their lives. you know, and it doesn't matter whether that's John Cleese or it's Jeffrey Palmer or it's Bernard Cribbins.
But it's Cleese that hired them, and it's Cleese that to some extent directed them. But yeah, I mean, you're right. Absolutely right. Quite the supporting right. cast is incredible.
It's the strength of what they do, and they're not trying to hog the limelight. They're just doing what they do. You know, they're carrying through the farce to its logical conclusion. That's one of the great joys of. If you want an excuse to go back and watch Fawlty Towers, go back and watch it. Now, I heartily recommend you do, and ignore John Cleese, Brunella Scales, and Andrew Sachs.
Watch the Major.
Just watch the Major.
The Major is incredible.
Ken Campbell, where Campbell appears in the one where it's Sybil's birthday, playing rather over jovial friend of the family. God, he's brilliant. All those people. Eunice Stubbs is in that one as well. So many people pop through those.
Bernard Cribbins, fantastic stand, isn't
he? Well, Cribbins can do no wrong, as we've repeatedly said on this podcast.
But they do deserve more credit, those guys, because the Oscars is entirely about Daniel Day-Lewis. That's the kind of world it occupies. It doesn't occupy the world of the comic actor.
No. So anyway, in the absence of anything happening in the music business, which it's clearly not, I thought we'd look back on records that came out this week 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Okay? 50.
Yeah. Go on.
Okay. So I'm going to go back, and I've got a few beside me here. Okay? So this week in 1970, okay? So how many years ago? That's 50 years ago.
50 years ago. Yeah.
There you go.
No dice. An interesting pop fact. Does anybody know who that girl is on the cover? I don't think they do. The band didn't know who she was. I think she was booked by Richard DiLello, was it? Who the guy worked
for? Richard DiLello, who's the way? That was the question I was going to ask you. Who took the picture? It was Richard DiLello, the guy.
Oh,
he took the picture. He was the house hippie at Apple.
Hippie is the guy who wrote The Longest Cocktail Party, fantastic book about Apple. But I think he just got a hold of her, I'm not sure if he even just saw her in some model agency or something. I don't think anybody knows who that girl is. The band had no idea at all. Extraordinary.
Gene Marn and Richard DiLello joint effort, it's called.
And so an extraordinary story, the development of that record, because you know, they Jeff Emerick had tried to produce it for a long time and failed.
Well, most of it is produced by Jeff Emerick. There's one track produced by Mal Evans.
Evans, yes. Beatles roadie. I know. But then after that, George Harrison came in, didn't he, for about a month? This was around the time.
Was it on this one?
Yeah, and then I think they got Todd Rundgren in for a while to try and produce it.
Oh, was that a later one?
Oh, was it? I don't think it was that one.
I'm not sure it was. It might be. Beatles experts will be able to tell us whether we're right or wrong on that. But anyway, so that's 50 years ago this week. Usual calculation, 50 years before that takes us to 1920. Okay. The Spanish flu is still.
Kicking in.
It's still around.
Oh Lord.
And then we go 40 years ago. This week, 40 big top 20 years ago this week, this came out. This is
Dirty Mind by Prince.
Prince's Dirty Mind, which I don't know this record terribly well, really. I mean, it kind of got overshadowed by later albums of his that were big successes. But it is kind of extraordinary to me that he belonged to the age of 1980. Don't you?
Yeah.
It seems like a long, long time ago. For him to have been
ahead of the game, and a weird record all about all sorts of peculiar stuff, isn't it? Incest and adventurous shagging.
Chris Gow
wrote a review of it, and he said it specialised in full-fledged fuckbook fantasies. He said Mick Jagger should fold up his penis and go home.
So he didn't, did he?
No, he didn't. No. So also Prince, who made 106 singles and 39 albums in 33 years. I can't think of anybody being more productive. That's astonishing, isn't it? The amount of songs he wrote, 106 singles came out during that time. I mean, the number of songs he wrote, absolutely extraordinary.
So I'm going to jump ahead, actually. I'm going to, because you talked about 106 singles, I'm going to talk about a group who made 27 singles that they all went to number one. And this came out 20 years
ago. Oh, I've got this. I've got it here.
Have you got it here?
Could it be that? It could.
It's yeah. that. It's, yeah, it's yeah. The Beatles number one, or it's just called One, wasn't it? Came out 20 years ago this week. Which contains, as it says on that little sticker on the cover, 27 number one singles on one CD. I don't think I've ever played it, really.
It's Have a fantastic... Played? I play a lot. It's fantastic.
Do you really?
Because you get the really early stuff, you know, and you know what that's going to be. And it's amazing also that it took so long for it to come out. It's, I mean, not till 2000, you know. But you also get Penny Lane, you get Eleanor Rigby. You get Something, you get Come Together. I mean, that's an incredible compilation, isn't it?
Okay, here's a challenge to you, Mark Ellen. What's the best track on One? Okay, we're both looking at the same record. Okay, you can only pick one.
I'd be tempted to go for Penny Lane, which I absolutely love.
I love Penny Lane.
That's a difficult one. She Loves You, I think, is hard to beat. Lady Madonna's fantastic too. All those clean up.
I'm going to tell you
what's the answer.
I'll tell you the answer, because I know you're in the dark, Mark, and you know I'm here to just lighten your darkness and tell you what the answer is. The greatest track on the Beatles number one is Back After These Messages.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
David Hepworth has posed the question, what is the best track on the Beatles' number one compilation? I think I know. Well, I
know the answer.
Either Penny Lane or it's Help. There are lots of contenders, but it's one of those two. Go on, tell me the answer.
Now, the answer, Mark, I'm so pleased to be able to put you right here. The answer is I Want to Hold Your Hand. And do you know why? Apart from the fact it's...
Because it's the record that conquered America? No, I don't know. Was it the one that finally came to form? It was
kind of that, and She Loves You. Finally came out kind of end of
63.
Yeah. In America, and were huge. And were the big hit records when they went to America in February 1964. But serious point. I mean, it's a fantastic record. But the thing that strikes me listening to the Beatles is there was a period during which they were making brilliant records that were made more brilliant by the fact that they were absolutely thrilled at how successful they were. And so you get this insane kind of, you know, it's like they all talk about football teams, you know, do they play well because they're confident, or are they confident because they play well, you know? And you get this virtuous circle. You just can't
There's
see
an
where it ends.
Incredible energy, isn't there? That's right.
Absolutely. Crackles. Jubilation. About, my God, we can do anything. Look at this. Yeah. We're on top of this thing. How long we'll stay on top of this thing, I do not know. But we're on a, you know,
but we're here and we're enjoying
We're on a unicycle going over a tightrope over Niagara Falls. And we're just going to bloody keep going, you know what I mean, for as long as it lasts. And you get that for the first time, I feel, even more than She Loves You, you get that in I Want to Hold Your Hand. That the way it starts, you think, the confidence with which it starts and flies to the finish. And that then animates, you know, Can't Buy Me Love, Hard Day's Night, I Feel Fine, all those things that come after it. So that's the answer,
Mark. I still can't believe, though, things that was She Loves You, that they wrote that on, what was it, a Wednesday or a Thursday night, I think, while they were on tour. I think they recorded it on the Saturday. And so it was only 2 or 3 days old. They tried it out, I think, on McCartney's dad to see if he liked it. No one else had heard it. And George and Ringo hadn't heard it when they came into the studio at Abbey Road to record it. And yet, later that day, it was finished. Do you think that's extraordinary? That they'd heard that song for the first time, arranged it and played it with that level of utter, utter perfection. It's phenomenal.
So we were talking about that. So that was 20 years ago this week that came out. And 30 years ago this week, which takes us to November 1990. This comes out, which is the second album by the Traveling Wilburys.
Called, amusingly, Traveling Wilburys Volume 3.
I'd only noticed that.
Yeah, though. I think so. It's just a hilarious George Harrison joke. Actually, the honest truth is they should never have done it. Roy Orbison was dead. It's got no... does anybody remember any of the songs on that? She's My Baby, Inside Out. Do you remember any of these songs? I don't.
I don't really. No.
But the first Traveling Wilburys album is absolutely... I think it came out in 88. It's fantastic.
It's a good record, isn't it?
It's a really, really, really good record. And all sorts of mythology was invented about how the group came together. And I think what happened was that George was having dinner, wasn't he, with Jeff Lynne and being asked to do another B-side for a track of his Cloud Nine album. And then, you know, and Roy Orbison was there and he asked him to come to the session. And then they said to Bob Dylan, could they use his studio in Malibu? And then asked Tom Petty if he'd like to bring a guitar. And so that's how they got together in the first place and decided, let's keep going. But, I mean, that's a fantastic record.
But the real kind of raison d'etre was Roy Orbison, really, wasn't it?
Well, I think it is because, you know, George made a little speech, according to Tom Petty, on the first day to Dylan, saying, look, we, you know, we're all rather in awe of you, but, you know, let's all just, you know, play on a level playing field here. But Dylan's point was he was in awe of, he claimed to be in awe of them, but also in awe of Roy Orbison. So the fact that Roy Orbison was there was from a different generation that they could all look up to. Was what brought them together, don't you think?
Also, Roy Orbison, genuinely unique voice, really. You know,
absolutely.
So it's like singing with Pavarotti, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
If you're a standard opera singer or something, very few people come along who have an instrument like Roy Orbison.
Yeah,
you know, and you hear it, on that first record. I might play that first record
that
later.
Soaring tenor. It's fantastic. But what great, the first record, Handle With Care, Dirty World, Tweedle and the Monkey Man. I mean, that's a really good record. And it sold millions, sold 3 million in the US alone.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. 600,000 in Canada. It's a fantastic record.
So those are my completely non-scientific musical anniversaries to make up for the fact there's nothing else going on this week. Although there was a story that we were looking at about somebody who had been signed by Universal Music. Was it about the age? I think they're not even born yet or something like that.
The girl called Angelina Jordan. No, she's born in 2000. She's signed at age 14 to Republic Records. I mean, she's a Norwegian girl. I mean, she's an amazing story. At the age of 7, she won a big talent contest in Norway. At the age of 8, she sang What a Wonderful World at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. And when she was 11, she sang to 40,000 people at a festival in South Korea. So she was already a massive star at the age of 11. Do you remember the old Peter Sellers Best of Sellers record? And a track on it called I'm Oh So Ashamed about a rock star who peaked at the age of 9. Her curly hair is getting thin. It's all those women in wine. And it's a grand tradition, isn't it? Kate Bush was signed when she was 16, wasn't she?
Well, yeah, she was, finally signed when she was 16, but she'd been around a little while.
She'd been around a while. David Gilmour discovered, I think, and made some demos with her. So she'd been around. And also the showbiz rock kid, Steve Marriott. Steve Marriott was the Artful Dodger when he was 13. In fact, there's a thread. Rock stars were the Artful Dodger. Phil Collins was the Artful Dodger. Also age 13. Yeah, Davy Jones of the Monkees.
Phil Collins' mother ran a stage school, didn't she?
That's right.
Dolenz,
I think.
Davy Jones was the Artful Dodger because Davy Jones was the Artful Dodger on the production of Oliver that opened in the United States at the same time as the Beatles arrived, and so he was on the first Ed Sullivan show with the Beatles.
That's right.
So he was in the wings.
I got the DVD
watching,
though.
Which is interesting because 2 years later, he was probably not even long as 2 years.
Yeah.
He was kind of doing an impression of them. But it strikes me that there's never been more people who presumably have, I mean, they're highly motivated young people, but they've probably got very motivated parents that get them on this ladder quite early. And the classic case of this is Taylor Swift. It's Taylor Swift's whole family.
Oh, she won a talent contest, didn't she, when she was about 4 or something?
Well, and they decided that Nashville was the place she ought to be, and they don't come from anywhere near Nashville. I think Dad was on Wall Street or was in finance or something like that. And so the upsticks went to Nashville to work with the factory songwriters to get her a start in
Incredible. Celine Dion, same sort of thing, wasn't it? When she was 13, I think she got a deal in 1981 or whatever, and her manager, I think, remortgaged his house because he believed so much she'd go. And she, I think she had a, she's a major, had a major hit when she was about 13 or 14 years old. I mean, it's astonishing.
You know what they always say in the world of tennis, where if you're looking for the next, you know, Steffi Graf or Serena Williams or whatever, don't look for talent, look for mad parents.
Well,
it's the mad parent who gets it's them there.
That's absolutely true. It's the it's the Jenny Murrays who, you know, if it's unkind to call her mad.
Jenny Murray is, well, Jenny Murray is a tennis pro, you know, so she kind of understands the business. She's got an excuse. But people like Richard Williams or Monica Seles' father or Andre Agassi's father. Go and read Andre Agassi's autobiography about how his father built a tennis court in the backyard in Las Vegas. And he knew nothing about tennis at all, but he just decided his son was going to be a top tennis player.
Yeah, yeah.
And was. But at what a cost to Andre Agassi. But who ended up marrying Steffi Graf, because you only marry somebody who's gone through the same thing.
Yes, you'd understand it.
You know. So,
but still leading the way on the starting early stage. Surely it's Michael Jackson, isn't it? Wasn't he six when he joined the Jackson Brothers?
He would.
Incredible. I think he was touring the Chitlin circuit when he was eight. I mean, that is just ridiculous. There's a driven father for you. Yes.
Yeah, they're not going away, are they? There's this kind of setup. We shall see more of this in the future.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Well, it's time for Any Other Business. We're joined by Alex Gold. Hello, Alex. How's the weather up there?
Actually, just as you said that, the sun came out.
Good.
Thanks, Dave.
It's as it has for Dave. Dave, you're in a patch of sunlight as well.
I nearly went and got sunglasses. I know. Yeah, let's hope it lasts all day. So what have we got? What have we got going on, Alex, to tell people about?
Well, we have a crowdcast event.
We do on Tuesday, don't we?
We do. You're absolutely right. Yes. Is it the 10cc book? It is. Yes. Where are we? Here it is.
Liam, have you got it there? Yeah, it's Liam Newton.
Liam Newton talking about the worst band in the world is the title of the book.
I'm looking forward to this.
I'll be good on 10cc. no great fondness, I feel. And that's something that should be rectified.
Yes, you should.
They made a lot of fantastic records.
Yeah, absolutely.
There isn't that kind of massive fan base sort of affection for them. Well, to be discussed.
But they did all so many things. You know, it's extraordinary, that book. How many different people and eras and genres across its pages, you know?
Absolutely.
They absolutely did everything. I'll be able to get my Hot Legs album out for that.
Have you got the album?
I've got the Hot Legs
album. Well, with Neanderthal Man.
With Neanderthal Man.
Oh, goodness.
It's called Thinks School Stinks. it's a kind of a Beano joke, I suppose. So that's coming up. And if you're a Patreon supporter, you'd be able to be in the room for that conversation, which takes place on Tuesday night, I think that's right.
It's on Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, absolutely.
Yeah.
What else is coming up? We've got the weekly quiz o'clock, which is now accompanies the kind of cocktail hour on a Friday evening, doesn't it? It kicks off at 6 o'clock, and it's entered a bold new dimension, hasn't it, by the introduction of picture clues now, pictures, in addition to the usual written clues. And so we get more and more people every week joining that. And, you know, if you win...
Bring your own crisps and woolly ale.
Exactly. Bring your own Old English cider and Walker's crisps. And, you know, if you do well enough, you may even get onto Alex's famous leaderboard.
Yeah.
And you remember, it's currently topped by Alex. I think we've got a new leader, haven't we?
There are two,
as joint,
two people jostling on the gold podium at the moment.
Right.
It's Matt Button, who's been number one for, I think, about 15 weeks.
Oh, what?
He's taking a lot of deposing, isn't he?
Yeah,
and I think it looks like his reign could be nearly over.
Well, Andrew Slattery has the plate.
He's the coming force.
Kinderman has made a glorious return to the third spot. It's an exciting time.
It's an exciting time in Friday night
it is.
Quizzes. So if you're a Patreon supporter, obviously you'll be able to join that and avail yourself of loads of other things. You'll be able to see everything that we do and hear everything that we do before anybody else hears it.
Absolutely.
That applies to just about everything. And over the next week, we're launching our list of the best music books of the year, which will hopefully be full of some suggestions if you want to put that in front of a relative who might buy you something for
relative
Christmas.
Thinking about Christmas.
And then we're also going to record little videos where we talk about each of those books. We're doing our usual word in your attics, which are going from strength to strength. Who we had over the last few weeks?
Chris Difford,
what a great shed, apart from anything
else. Absolutely, the world's most enviable shed.
Ideal shed. Shed and Garden magazine would have surely been beating a path to his...
And Stuart Bailey, we had a fantastic one. Stuart Bailey talking about his Van Morrison album.
Van Morrison book, yeah. We've had over the last few weeks, we've had Billy Bragg, of course. Exactly. It's all there. Go on YouTube/Word in Your Ear. It's absolutely all there for you to enjoy. But please, we'd like you to take part as much as possible and to go and look at being a Patreon supporter. You go to patreon.com/Word in Your Ear and you find out what level you might like to get involved at. Is there anything further to say, Alex?
Yes, I think we should say hello to our new patrons.
Oh, right.
Oh, go on, yes.
This week, Simon Hemsley, the great Simon Hemsley.
Thank you, Simon.
Doug Popper, who is an annual patron.
Give me the first name again. I missed that.
Simon Hemsley.
Yeah, the first name of the second person. Go on.
Doug Hopper.
Doug Hopper. Right, Doug fine. Hopper. Hello, Doug. Right.
He's an annual patron. Of course, if you subscribe annually, you get a hefty 15% discount. So worth doing.
Makes sense.
If you do it in time for your birthday, you get the prospect of me and Mark Ellen coming down your digital chimney.
That's right.
Great, man.
Rummaging through your record collection. Very good fun. Yeah.
We've done quite a few of those. Special Word in Your Attic, which we've done quite a few of those already. So you might like to think about those if you've got a birthday coming up soon. Anyway, carry on, Alex.
Also, Martin Whitley.
All right, Martin. Thank you very much. Nice to see you all. Nice to see you all on board.
Nice to see you.
To see you nice.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.